And having that science-based concept of the distinction between map and territory is very helpful for keeping us humble and keeping us skeptical. And that is a very important quality for the secular community and for all reason-based people, to be skeptical about what we perceive in reality as true, and to be even skeptical about our own thoughts and emotions, and reflect on if there is evidence in the world to actually support what we think.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. This week, helping others find meaning in life. Can science help in this area? And cool accents. All coming up in this week's episode. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett.
I'm Kim Ellington.
Yeah, it's good to be back. How are you, Kim?
I'm good, Bo. How are you?
Doing well. Doing well. Let's talk about a couple things. You had something that you wanted to talk about. Why don't you start? Go.
I do. Okay. So there are, in this country, 7 states still with laws on the books that forbid atheists from holding public office.
Wow.
And yeah, can you believe it? North Carolina is one of them. So guess what fight I'm fighting now, though.
Yeah, I could imagine. Well, are these laws, Kim, the kind of laws like you find it's illegal to have a moose with an earring, like those stupid things that you find that are actually real laws but are still kind of leftovers from the 17th century or something? Or are these laws that people take seriously?
Well, in North Carolina, it was actually used. Cecil Bothwell is a city councilman in Asheville, North Carolina, up in the mountains. And his opponents tried to use this against him when he was running originally. Mm. However, the Supreme Court of the United States has said that this is not legal and it can't be done. So we need to get this off the books. This needs to come off. Can you imagine if our politicians decided that some other group could no longer hold office, if women couldn't run for office, if black people couldn't run? I mean, everybody would be up on the Catholics. This is actually something I learned last night, that the Catholics were originally in North Carolina banned from running for public office.
Huh.
So I'm pretty sure that most normal is not the word, we'll say, you know, moderate thinking, even any kind of religious people would say at least that everybody has the opportunity in this country to run for office. So I'm hoping that our politicians will listen to reason, but it is a hard sell in this state for sure.
I would think that even the fact that it's just on the books sends some kind of message to everybody saying, oh, geez, you know, what's wrong with atheists? If this is a law, there must be something wrong with them.
Yeah, it's government-sanctioned discrimination, right?
Yeah, people just don't know enough, so they think, okay, I better not vote for this guy. Let's vote for the person who doesn't have a law against them taking office.
Yes. Yep.
Oh, that's crazy.
It is crazy. But we're going to fix the crazy.
You fix that, and then you report back to me and tell me how you did.
Yeah, don't expect that next week. I think this one might take a little time.
All right, I'll catch you back in 2 weeks. How's that?
All right. That'll do.
All right. There was an article on thehumanist.com titled Religious Vandalism, Prank, or Hate Crime. In short, there was a billboard that was put up in Butte County. I'm not even sure where that is. I apologize, but it doesn't matter for the story. The billboard was put up and it said something like, you don't believe in God, join the club. And then Butte County Atheists. And somebody or some group of people came along and ripped off the billboard, the part where it says don't, and the atheists. So when you see the billboard now, there's like a big scratched off part that looks like somebody scratched off a lottery ticket. And it just says, believe in God, join the club. And then Butte County without atheists.
Oh my goodness.
Right. And now the big question is this just kind of like a funny prank? Is it an annoying prank? Or is it a hate crime?
Right.
What do you think, Kim?
I don't think it's a funny prank. I think that's definitely somebody did that on purpose.
Well, let me ask you this.
That's a little too directed.
Right. If the billboard said, believe in God, join the club, and then somebody came across with a can of spray paint and spray painted don't in front of there, and then atheists after it, would that be any funnier?
I don't know. I don't think so. You know, I think I am, because of what we do and who we are, I'm pretty... Personally, I'm a little bit militant is probably not the right word, but, you know, freedom of speech is a big deal. We have to put up with a lot, but, you know, we don't need to do the same thing to other people.
Right.
And we haven't, I don't think we've actually seen any incidences of that happening, probably for that exact reason. And we have enough as non-believers to work against without creating more trouble for ourselves.
Yeah.
Have you seen what people are saying about this?
It's mixed. It's mixed. And there are several people coming on the comments that say that this isn't a hate crime. Let's not get carried away. It's just an act of vandalism. Nobody got hurt. There's no physical abuse going on here. And it's just a simple act of vandalism. I mean, it is a criminal offense, but it's not. Let's just not get carried away. And then there are other people saying, no, it's definitely a hate crime because it's against a group. It's a crime committed against a group, atheists. But then people are coming back and saying, well, it's not committed against a group. It's committed against a billboard, you know, a piece of paper. So the argument's going back and forth, and there's a lot of good points on both sides. I'm of the mindset where I have trouble with the whole idea of hate crimes to begin with. And this was pointed out in the comments too. It's not a very original thought, but the whole idea of hate crimes is really getting dangerously close to the idea of thought police and what we're thinking while we're committing a crime. It could make the crime worse or better, but I guess that's part of the legal system. But now our thoughts need to be monitored in some way. And if it's against a group, it's a hate crime. I don't know.
Yeah,
like, here was an example that I threw out there to somebody. I said, well, okay, if this is a hate crime, then what if there was a Nazi symbol, a swastika, drawn on a spray painted on an overpass or something, and then I came along with a can of spray paint and spray painted over it because I was offended by the message, and I didn't want to see that in my hometown. Am I guilty of a hate crime? And by the same logic, by the same reasoning, I would have to be, would I not? Because I'm doing something against a group. I'm suppressing their freedom of speech. I guess the difference here is that a billboard is a legal form of advertisement, where spray painting a swastika on some kind of overpass is illegal. You know, you're vandalizing. I'm basically covering up vandalism or vandalizing over a vandalism.
Yeah.
But the idea should at least make you think. And now what we define as a hate crime depends on what side you are on for the given group. Like, I'm thinking let's just say they were Christians who did this. I think that's a pretty fair assumption. Or believers in God. They could be Muslims. They could be Hindus. I don't know. But let's say that they're certainly believers in God, and they believe that they're on the right side of the debate. And what they're doing by doing this is they're spreading their message of love. We may not agree with that at all, and we may be against that, but that's what's in their mind. So are they really guilty of hate?
The crimes that have been committed against human beings, when a gay person is beat to death,
mm-hmm.
or beat at all because they're gay, that's a hate crime. But a billboard, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't want those two things to be equal. I bet somebody's pretty proud of themselves. So I can see in my mind somebody giggling about, look what we did, look what we did. The good news is it actually brings us press, though, that this is getting out there.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I guess there weren't a lot of people who knew who the Butte County Atheists were before now.
That's
so
right.
Congratulations, y'all.
That's right. Some free press.
Good job.
All right. Well, let's get into our interview today. Our interview today is with a gentleman who is running an organization focusing on online education, mostly for the... I'm not even sure if it's strictly for the secular crowd or for everybody, but taking a science-based approach. But these are the kind of questions we're going to ask him. So let's get right to it. And Kim and I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Gleb Sipursky. How you doing, Gleb?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Bo, and thank you, Kim, for speaking with me. Really excited.
Oh, we're glad you're here. This is great.
This is wonderful. Tell us about Intentional Insights. You have a website called intentionalinsights.org. What's that all about?
Well, so we're a new organization, and we're basically just about helping folks think better, helping people think better to evaluate their reality, make effective decisions, and reach their goals. That's what basically what we're about. Can tell you a little bit more about it, or you can ask me questions.
Well, let me ask you questions about thinking better. How exactly do you go about doing that? Obviously, I think a lot of people think, hey, I think fine. I don't need your lousy course, Gleb.
That's right. Let me tell you about how we do it. So basically, there's been a lot of recent research in psychology, cognitive neuroscience, brain science in general, and other disciplines as well, that is currently trapped in a lot of really dense academic literature. And, you know, I'm a professor, and I study history, so I kind of bring together a lot of different disciplines and also multicultural perspective, and I can understand this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's not really stuff that people generally read, or they don't get an opportunity to read it and translate it to themselves and apply it to their lives. So what we are about is trying to take this stuff, this academic dense literature stuff, and translate it in a way that's really helpful for people in their everyday life, and especially for reason-minded folks like we have in the secular community and the American Humanist Association in particular, you know, just helping us all think better from a brain science-based perspective.
So what would be an example of that? Give us an example of people that, of the work that you've translated for people to find that easier for them.
Sure. Glad to give you an example. So one example is the concept of planning fallacy. It's a very easy concept once you actually get to know it. Basically, our brains intuitively think that everything we do will go according to plan. That's just the way our brains work. You know, we think everything will go perfect. We don't intuitively think that, like, oh, you know, there's a 10% chance that when we go out to get to somewhere, our car will run into some traffic. And there's a 1% chance of something breaking down, or we forget something at home and have to come back. And so we don't leave until it's actually, we have the perfect amount of time to get somewhere. So we end up often getting there in time, but in a lot of the time we end up being late, and we don't know why we're late. It just happens that we're late. Mm-hmm. But really, it's a predictable problem, and you can actually deal with it by building in extra resources and time to account for this cognitive bias, for this basic thinking error called planning fallacy. And that's just one example of what we identify and strategies that we bring to deal with things like planning fallacy and so on.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Kim Ellington, and we're speaking with Dr. Gleb Sipor-Sky about intentional insights. Well, that's interesting because a lot of the cognitive science that we read, whether it be in some kind of online blog or if it's actually in a scientific journal, it's generally kind of boring and dry stuff. And I think you already mm-hmm. alluded to that. You sound like science educators. Mm-hmm. taking the detailed information from the literature and then presenting it in such a way where people can understand it. But you seems like you go beyond that, at least with that example, because this is something that people could actually use and implement in their lives to make their lives better. A lot of the stuff we read is just theoretical or, oh, this is interesting, but it's not going to change the fact that I don't have a job or something like this. But the example that you gave, it is something that people could actually put to use. Is that pretty common of the things you write about?
Very much so. And I think you're right on track, Bo, where you notice that it's very practical stuff, pragmatic stuff that's relevant to people's lives that they can actually use. And you yourself, I think you almost got your doctorate, if I'm not mistaken.
A couple more weeks.
Excellent. Good luck.
Thanks.
So perfect. So you know yourself that there's a lot of research that's out there that's so practical and so pragmatic if it can be translated to a broad audience. And here's an example of a blog posts that we just put out. And blog posts are one of the main ways we deliver our content at intentionalinsights.org. So this blog post talks about a concept called fundamental attribution error. Now, I know that sounds sciencey and scary, but it's actually pretty simple once we think about it. So basically, when we are, let me give you an example. When we're driving and we are cut off by someone, we have an intuitive feeling that that guy or girl is a jerk. Oh no, how can they cut us off? But when we cut off somebody, we don't think ourselves as we are jerks. We think, oh, okay, I didn't see anyone, or, you know, I just really need to make that turn. So we automatically, our brains, the way they function, is they attribute positive characteristics to us and negative characteristics to others. So this is called fundamental attribution error. Now, if we know that that's the way we function, we can intuitively correct for it, and we can notice whenever we think negatively of somebody else because of what they do, we can think, okay, are they actually, we can notice the evidence and see, did they actually do the thing because they're a jerk? Or is this something they happen to do and it doesn't fundamentally mean that they are a jerk? We can observe all of their other activities and see whether they are a jerk or not a jerk based on what else they do. And so that is where we can actually get at the grain, at the science-based perspective of it.
Yeah, that's so, an excellent example, because we tend to ignore the situational factors. So when we see somebody cut us off, we have no idea what's going on in their lives right now. Or maybe their kid in the front seat like whacked them, or screaming in the back, or maybe they're on their way to the hospital and the wife's pregnant in the back seat. I mean, who knows? There could be a lot of things going on, but we don't think that. We think this person is just an idiot.
Exactly. And that's wrong. And this is really a very powerful concept. And this is one of so many things that go on in our head. Kind of just these, they're basic thinking errors. They're emotional intuitions that we have about the world that are somewhat off. And we can really deal with them using very pragmatic strategies. So let me tell you about one strategy that's very helpful. It's called map and territory. Basically, it's a difference between the mental map in our heads and the territory of reality. And we all have a vision of what the world is like in our heads, a mental map. And it never matches the territory of what is actually real. That's true. We can't ever know exactly what's real. We can think about what's real, but we can't know what's real. And having that concept, just a science-based concept of map, the distinction between map and territory, is very helpful for keeping us humble and keeping us skeptical. And that is a very important quality for the secular community and for all reason-based people, to be skeptical about what we perceive in reality as true, and to be even skeptical about our own thoughts and emotions, and really be reflect on whether our own thoughts and emotions, if there is evidence in the world to actually support what we think, or if there is no evidence for that.
That's excellent. I was thinking back about in middle school, there were so many lessons where I would get into an altercation with someone, either a good or a bad one, or I won't use those words, but a positive or a challenging one between another person. And I would think of just the right thing to say overnight, and I would plan it out and address every issue that we had in between us with no regard to the fact that that other person was doing the same thing. And it was so confusing the next day when I wanted to talk it out, but they were in another headspace. Then it felt like I had to start all over again.
Yeah. It sounds, and one of the things that we talk about with Intentional Insights is how to manage relationships effectively. And that's a very complex concept, how to manage interpersonal dynamics and relationships. And one really helpful approach is thinking about being intentional, not only about the issue, but about the dynamics between us. So, for example, with a friend, like, you know, in middle school or right now, we can, if we have a tension, if we have a conflict, we can either keep fighting that same fight over and over again, or we can step back and say, wait, I notice that we have been fighting the same fight over and over again. Do we really want to keep fighting this fight over and over again? I know my emotions are different from your emotions. I know my thought patterns are different from your thought patterns. We can just agree to disagree and be okay with our friend not being the same person that we are. There's a basic thinking error that we have called failure at other minds. And this is because our mind intuitively models all other minds, and especially those of people close to us, as the same as our own. And that's never true. That's a mistake of map and territory. You know, the map that other people have in their heads is never the same as our map. And so if we accept that and are welcoming of that difference between us, we can have a much less stressful life, more emotionally fulfilling life, and have much better relationships and communication with other people.
Now, that's such an important point. I think parents especially should really consider that, what you just said. A lot of times as parents, we think that our children think like us or should think like us. We forget that, especially when they're going through the teens, that they have a completely different mindset. They're really focused on themselves. And this is just part of normal human development. People go through stages, and at that age, they're focused on themselves. And then as they get older, they start focusing on other people. And it's just kind of like the cycle of life. And if we don't keep that in the back of our mind, we tend to have all this built-up anger and resentment towards this person, and we completely forget that the poor kid is just 8 years old.
Yes, yes. I think you're absolutely right, Bo. We tend to forget, and we as a society are not really well set up to educate our kids about how our minds work. So even within the secular community, we have wonderful educators in hard science. For example, people like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bill Nye, they talk about the physical environment, about biology, about the universe as a whole, and that's wonderful, and that's great. Mm-hmm. But we really don't have people who talk about brain science and research-based ways of understanding and improving our minds and our interactions with others. And I know, Bo, that's something that you want to do with your positivehumanism.org website. And that's wonderful. And it's great that there are such people appearing in the movement and for the broad society as a whole. And we at Intentional Insights, this is what our goal is, to bring brain science, research-based ways of understanding and improving our minds' interactions with others. It's a self-improvement, a science-based self-improvement, a reasoned science-based self-improvement approach that kids can benefit from, adults can benefit from, everyone can benefit from, and really gain a great deal of mental well-being and less emotional stress and better communication and relationships with other people.
Well, I was going to ask you about how humanists can use this information to help themselves and help society, but you very clearly answered that. The whole time we were talking, we were mentioning terms like understanding, kindness, humility, skepticism, fairness. And these are all important humanistic values that I think any humanist would cling on to. And these are the kind of things that they can get from your course or from your site. But here's a question for you. Yes. Is the content on your website geared specifically towards the secular crowd? And if so, how?
So the content on our website is geared toward the secular crowd and other crowds. So right now, the content on our website, our first big offering is a science-based way to find purpose in life. It's called Find Your Purpose Using Science. And a lot of secular folks feel this sort of emptiness deep in the pit of their stomach. It's a hard thing to come away from religious perspectives with the society around us, mainstream dogma, saying that religion is the way to find meaning and purpose. Well, my own research is on how people find purpose from a secular perspective, from various secular societies. So that's my own scholarship. As I mentioned, I'm a professor at Ohio State, and I look at these things. And I brought together a research from psychology, cognitive neuroscience, history, sociology, and a lot of different disciplines. And collaborated with our great team of folks at Intentional Insights to develop an offering that uses science-based ways to find purpose and meaning in life. So we have blogs. We have a number of blogs on our website that lead people through science-based ways to find research and purpose and to find meaning and purpose in life. So again, that's intentionalinsights.org. We also videotaped some workshops on finding meaning and purpose in life, and so folks can watch those workshops. Also created an online class, which you can find at dowellwebtools.com. If you go to our website, intentionalinsights.org, there are links to it available over there in our blogs. So you can find that online course that takes you through a number of steps and uses reason-based ways to find research and purpose. I'm also writing a workbook that is a coherent set of exercises, activities, narratives that describes the research on meaning and purpose and describes the thinking on meaning and purpose from a variety of perspectives, emphasizing the philosophy of existentialism, which is basically the importance of finding meaning and purpose from inside oneself, from deep self-reflection. And that is actually a really science-based way of finding meaning and purpose, which we can talk about later if we want to about the book. But that is something we're doing. We're also creating, I also created a questionnaire that people can use to evaluate their meaning and purpose. And we're creating a web and mobile app that folks can use to track and graph their sense of meaning and purpose over time.
Nice.
Now, I would say if you and I were just talking, which we are, so this is very convenient, that we don't find meaning and purpose in our life. We create it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think.
So did I just solve your website?
You made a wonderful observation and one that gets at the heart of meaning-making activities. So what I do in the book and in the course, what we do at Intentional Insights is describe the kind of meaning and purpose-making activities that you can do. And they're basically three science-based ways of finding purpose and meaning in life. And again, this is both based on cognitive neuroscience psychology and how people in other cultures find meaning and purpose in their lives. And one is deep self-reflection on meaning and purpose. That includes things like talking about it with others, thinking about it for oneself, journaling about it. It's a very powerful strategy to journal. So that's one set of strategies, self-reflection. Another set of strategies relates to building community. So community building shows that building communities is an incredibly powerful means of creating meaning and purpose in one's life. So creation, cultivating and maintaining community and social bonds. And the third way is serving others. So serving others, serving a broader community through volunteering, that's one way, through various forms of civic engagement, through philanthropy, and through political engagement. So those are all three broad areas of meaning-making activities. So you're spot on, Kim. You're absolutely right. It is something we make for ourselves, and that's what the workbook, that's what the web app, that's what the online course, the blogs, and the videos help folks do.
That sounds really great. I hear a lot from other folks. I haven't run across it myself, but where religious folks, their friends or relatives ask them, well, if you don't have God in your life, what meaning do you have? What is your purpose? So this sounds for folks that are still struggling and learning how to live a more secular life. This sounds like a great resource.
Hmm. I always found that question interesting. It's like, well, if you don't have somebody dictating what the meaning is in your life, then how do you find the meaning? Well, it's like, well, if somebody's not dictating it, then think of all the freedom you have to create your own meaning.
Exactly. And you know what? That actually relates to research that shows that meaning that you find yourself through self-reflection tends to be quite a bit more a richer and deeper sense of purpose and meaning than one just externally imposed by others, that dogmatic sense of meaning and purpose imposed often by religion and other kind of cultural traditions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good thing you mentioned other cultural traditions, because it's not only religion that imposes meaning. It can be cultures. It can be society. It can be just parents, some kind of like family values. Like, for example, the younger son needs to take over and become a surgeon just like his father. And there's a lot of that pressure that that children face. And we know this. We know this from decades of research, that this is is not good at all.
I so identify with that. You know, when I was a kid, my parents really wanted me to go to medical school and become a medical doctor. I had a major, major confrontation with them. Really, my first moment of real independence from my parents was in my senior year of college, when I was just about to go to medical school. And I always loved history. So that's, you know, I eventually went into history. I always loved history, but I planned to go into medical school. And when I was going to medical, when I was applying for these applications, there was one application that said, well, why do you want to become a medical doctor? And I was like, oh, wait, I'm not sure I want to become a medical doctor. You know, why? And that was my first, like, sort of quarter life crisis. So yeah, that's when I really felt that if I became a doctor, I wouldn't have a sense of purposeful life. Like, I wouldn't have a sense of meaning in life. I would just have that emptiness in me. And this is really one reason why I decided to become a historian and specialize in studying how folks in secular societies, societies other than the United States, found meaning and purpose in their life. And that was really a way that I got into meaning and purpose research in the first place. And so that's how I was able to pull this stuff together. So it was kind of came from my own story of wanting to find meaning and purpose in life. And that was a really powerful experience that I had. And I'm really glad I chose not to go to medical school.
Yeah, I think so. All right, we're going to take a little break, but when we get back, I want you to share your opinion with us on what you think about all those people who actually like to conform and like to be told what their goal in life should be. Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Kim Ellington, and we're speaking with Dr. Gleb Sipirsky about intentional insights.
Well, what the actual research suggests on this topic, so there's been quite a bit of research on emotional management and on conformism. And that's another major area that I study, emotions and conformism. And my research and those of others shows that there are a lot of folks who are very comfortable with conforming to the mainstream norms, whatever the mainstream norms in their culture, in their society, in their background happens to be. The problem comes when these norms are very binding, restrictive, and so there are people who are comfortable with certain within these restrictive norms, but also people who grow up in those settings who are not comfortable with being restricted, who want more choices. And because they want more choices and their cultural setting, whether it's the religion, whether it's their parents, whatever it may be, does not permit them to have these choices, to have these options. It closes off these paths. They feel really restricted and they don't feel empowered. They feel like they lack personal agency in life. They don't feel like they can make those choices, and they just suffer. They suffer in those settings. And that's one of the things that I want to prevent, that we in Intentional Insights want to prevent with this offering on meaning and purpose and other offerings. We want to prevent people from suffering. We want them to know that there are other options. They don't have to pursue those options, but it's really important for them to know that there are other options to finding meaning and purpose in life, not only the ones that are given to them by their restrictive cultural heritage. Again, whether it happens to be religion, parents, or whatnot.
Yeah, you know, one of the common debates that goes around in the atheist slash Christian communities is this idea of meaning. And the Christians might argue that the reason we are atheists is because we are rebelling against God, or we don't like what God has planned for us, or we don't want to follow God's rules. And I think there is some logic to that. because I could see that as a big motivation. For example, if I were Jewish and I had to follow these, 614 rules, I could never do it. I would probably find a way to reason myself out of that religion. It's what was referred to as motivated reasoning. But I think something else is going on here. One of the perks of hosting this podcast is I get to do a lot of informal qualitative research, if you will, by talking to a lot of incredibly interesting people. And many of these people who have been through this process of deconversion, going from a Christian to a secular worldview. In one example, I was speaking with somebody who was gay, and he obviously is now an atheist. And I asked him, I said, well, do you think it's because of these feelings that you had and this idea that your religion did not want you to be gay, that's why you gave up on religion and became an atheist? And he explained to me very clearly, no, that's not it. It was the fact that I was gay that caused me to do the research and really critically think about my religion. And it was the knowledge that I gained from that process that led me to be an atheist.
Yeah, I could really identify with that. I think that there are lots of people who are already, you know, for various reasons, like we talked about, the restrictions placed on them, whether it's on them being gay or whether it's on about their, you know, economic status or various other issues, that they are feel restricted and confounded, bound within religious societies, within religious communities, or again, from other cultural perspectives also. So I think that's definitely one case scenario. I think another case scenario is that there are lots of folks who just simply don't know that there are options. They don't know. And if they knew that there was another way of finding meaning and purpose, they would, some of them might just explore and see and gain a richer understanding of meaning and purpose in their life, and they might become they might stay religious. It's not a problem. There's, you know, religious people also can find meaning and purpose in life, of course, but they would have a richer understanding of meaning and purpose. And I think another, so that's another audience demographic. I think another situation is that people who are religious generally don't think that secular people have meaning and purpose in their life. They tend to think that no, those secular folks, they're just completely, they don't have meaning and purpose. There's no way they can have meaning and purpose without God. So it's really helpful for them to be educated and learn about the kind of meaning and purpose that secular people can have using science, using research-based strategies, that science can answer big life questions. Science can be used as an approach to answer ethics, morals, purpose, meaning, and so on. And that's just not something that theologians, that religion is willing to currently acknowledge. And the offering and meaning and purpose and the workbook that I'm writing and the online course that I'm teaching really shows how we can, as reason-minded people, as science-based people, find meaning and purpose in our lives. And I hope it will help religious folks understand that as well.
So when someone comes up to a non-believer and confronts them about with a preconceived belief that there is no way we can have meaning or purpose in our lives, it seems like we need many people need an actual skill, an actual almost a template of how to explain that our brains are what create our meaning and purpose. And so it isn't an outside force. It isn't necessarily a God. And so some more of your interpersonal teachings would probably be helpful on that point for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Kim. I think explaining to people that how we can find meaning and purpose in our lives from a science-based perspective is a really powerful thing. And I think here, there are several ways to go. I think one of them is to turn to research and say that to the religious person, saying that, well, you have your perspective, I have my perspective. What does the science say? Because generally, religious people, if they are reasonable religious people, they can use science. So that's an outside standard, you know. And we can turn to science and say, well, here's what the science on meaning and purpose says. And, you know, we digest at Intentional Insights, digest that and present it in a way that's folks, secular folks can actually use and demonstrate, well, here's what the science says. Here are science-based ways of finding meaning and purpose. Here is how I use these science-based ways to find meaning and purpose in my life. How did you find meaning and purpose in your life, religious person? So using science as that outside objective force, as that outside objective external criteria, is a very powerful way that we as secular people, that we as, and we as science-based, reason-based people, you know, people don't have to be secular to take this approach. They can also be just reason-based people. They can find meaning and purpose in their lives using science and explain it to others.
Hmm. So, Gleb, I have to ask you this because you said something that's pretty controversial, and that's the whole idea that science can really help us with purpose, ethics, meaning in life. There are many atheists who would not agree with that, who would say maybe they would concede and say, okay, science can inform moral decisions. Science can inform us when we're developing our own meaning, but ultimately, science can't answer ethical questions. It can't answer questions about meaning. Can you address that? Maybe you agree with that statement, or maybe science really can answer questions of ethics or morals?
So science can answer questions that are based on the research. So we don't know what eventually science will answer. Mm-hmm. We can only know what science has currently dealt with. And currently, the most recent scientific research, which is described in the blog and the workbooks and the online course, has dealt very clearly with how we as individuals can find meaning and purpose in life. And we can clearly see that here is the science, at core, that people who do these activities that I described earlier definitely develop a greater sense of purpose and meaning. Now, that doesn't mean that each individual who will do each individual thing develops a greater sense of purpose and meaning. There's no guarantee. It is just that the science says that doing these activities, self-reflection, community building, serving others, are highly correlated with people, after they do these activities, experiencing a greater sense of purpose and meaning in life. So if the question is, can science help you get a greater sense of purpose and meaning in life? There's a pretty definitive answer that yes, it can.
Okay. That makes certainly a lot of sense. All right. I do want to go back to this idea of finding or discovering whatever meaning and purpose with God, and how some religious people view this, because I don't like putting all religious people in the same box. Mm-hmm. And I alluded to already that there's this idea that within religion, you have to become a priest or become a nun or serve God or pray to God every night, and that's your purpose in life. But especially with more liberal Christians, that's not the case. What I've heard, the way that they've explained it to me, is that they would discover meaning and purpose the same way that we would, or they would create it the same. They wouldn't use that term, but they would essentially create their meaning and purpose, do what they want to do, find their niche in life the same way that everybody else does, except what they're doing is they're crediting God for it. And they're saying, God gave me this information. He put this path in front of me. Basically, it's just a way of rationalizing the whole concept of God and the idea that they really kind of chose their own path and putting the two together. So I wanted to just say that, because I didn't want to leave everybody with the impression that anybody who's Christian has to pray to God every night and that's their own purpose in life.
I think that's a really good point, Bo. I discussed and received feedback on this book extensively on my the Purpose and Meaning offering from Caleb Pitkin, who's a United Methodist minister here, right here in Columbus, Ohio. And we discussed this workbook. We discussed how Christian people find meaning and purpose in life. And he helped me, he helped inform that perspective for me and helped enrich the workbook. So to discuss and put in the God-oriented purpose and meaning. And what how he described it from his perspective is that religious people, they don't make the assumption that purpose and meaning comes from within me. They make the assumption that purpose and meaning comes from God and me, or at least liberal Christian people like Caleb Pitkin and others in his congregation. So there is a combination of those concepts. But there, the basic axiomatic assumption, the basic assumption is that there is a God, and that is a source of purpose and meaning, and that combines with oneself. So that is how he described it as liberal religious Christian people looking at purpose and meaning in life.
The result is the same, essentially. It's just that they're adding in a little unfalsifiable component to it that fits within their doctrine. Correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand, you don't care really about what their beliefs are. Your goal is to help people find meaning and purpose. And if they want to do it under an umbrella of religiosity, they can do that. But your primary focus is on the secular crowd.
My primary focus is on the science-based crowd. So it's the secular crowd is part of the science-based crowd. But there are plenty of other folks in our society who really appreciate science. They're not necessarily part of the secular movement, you know. We have a lot of nuns, people who don't belong and don't identify themselves by religion, who don't go to church. Even some folks who go to church, who go to a liberal, who go to, at least from a liberal perspective, like Caleb Pitkin, the United Methodist minister who I mentioned, he was really interested in this workbook. He was really interested in what the science had to say about finding meaning and purpose in life. I think this is something that a lot of folks are looking for. It's especially helpful for secular people, but even for people who are not currently part of the secular movement, it's helpful for them. And we as an organization, Intentional Insights, we're partnering with a lot of secular organizations to bring it to their audience, with the American Humanist Association, Secular Student Alliance, Sunday Assembly, the Unitarian Universalist Humanists, and so on. And we're in discussion with a number of others to bring our content to their audiences. But I think this stuff, science-based ways of looking at ourselves, at our big life questions, at evaluating reality clearly, as I was mentioning in Planning Fallacy earlier, at effective decision-making, at managing our emotions rationally, those are all things that we can all benefit from.
Well, thank you for that, Gleb, because I think we all need a reminder, those of us in the secular community, that the religious community aren't all anti-science. And there are many people in the religious community that really do appreciate a science-based approach to many things. It's just they just reserve that one part of their religiosity or the supernatural to their own personal beliefs, and we can't write off that crowd. And I think it's great the way that you have this course set up, and you have all your information geared towards the larger audience, because I think those are the people that we really need to reach, and this is kind of a good way of doing that. So, Gleb, how can people find out more information about your organization, and where would you want to send them?
I'd encourage them just to go to intentionalinsights.org. So that's www.intentionalinsights.org, and check out our blogs, videos, online classes, other content. Sign up for our newsletter. The newsletter is up there. Sign up to volunteer your time and skills and contribute your funding as well. We'd really love to hear from you. Check us out. I'm excited to get to know all of you who are listening to the Humanist Hour podcast.
All right. Gleb, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for being on with us. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Bob
thank
and Kim.
You. Yeah, thank you.
All right, that was Dr. Gleb Sapolsky. So what do you think, Kim?
I thought he was lovely.
He was a lovely
really neat. What a great idea. He wanted to do something, and he put that action in motion to create something that's going to help human beings. I love it.
And what a cool accent, too, huh?
We do love accents.
Yeah. Gotta love the accents. All right. Well, this has been a great show. Kim, thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. I was glad to be here, Bo.
All right. And to our listening audience, if you do have any feedback for us on this show or any other show, we'd love to hear from you. You could send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org, or you could call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. And just another quick reminder of the American Humanist Association's 74th Annual Conference, coming up May 7th through 10th, 2015 in Denver, Colorado. This is going to be taking place at the Denver Grand Hyatt Hotel. I've never been there before, but from the pictures, it looks very nice. And of course, the website wouldn't put pictures of their hotel on there that didn't look nice. So it's got to be a nice hotel. And who is going to be receiving awards? Some of these people you may have heard of: Lawrence Krauss, Gene Kilborn, Marcy Hamilton, and The Onion, America's finest news source. So check it out. You can find the website at conference.americanhumanist.org. And thanks for joining us this week. My name is Bo Bennett.
I'm Kim Ellington. Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.